to revive the 2015 Iran deal coming to an end. The dialogue faces a make-or-break moment in the coming days. A draft text of an agreement between Iran and the P4+1 group, namely Russia, China, Britain, France, and Germany, is almost complete. The diplomatic effort seems to be near a climax, but still the very few remaining gaps in the text are keeping the whole thing in limbo, and a final failure is still a possibility. There has been a flurry of diplomatic efforts in Vienna's Palais Coburg Hotel, the venue of the marathon negotiations. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh said on Thursday that talks between Iran and the P4+1 are still ongoing, and no one can say that an agreement has been reached until all outstanding important issues are resolved. The Iranian foreign ministry spokesman said extra efforts are needed to resolve the remaining issues and that everyone is now focused on the final key steps. Meanwhile, Russia's chief negotiator in Vienna says the talks are unlikely to end in failure. Mikhail Ulyanov told reporters in Vienna on Thursday evening that the remaining issues are few but need to be addressed. Ulyanov's comments were echoed by Britain's chief negotiator in Vienna, Stephanie Alkagh, who said the parties are very close to an agreement. The Iranian side insisted that the talks in the Austrian capital have to reach a good deal or there will be no deal at all. Negotiators in Vienna have been trying to find a way to remove American unilateral sanctions against Iran and allow the U.S. to return to the 2015 deal. The U.S. sanctions were imposed after the U.S. unilateral withdrawal from the JCPOA in 2018. U.S. President Joe Biden has acknowledged that his predecessor's pullout was wrong, but Biden's words have done little to solve America's credibility problem that is largely blamed on Donald Trump. Tehran now says the sanctions must be removed in a verifiable manner, and Washington must offer guarantees that it will not abandon the agreement again. The United States has been dragging its feet so far, but Tehran says it will not back down from its red lines.
Iran can't go through the same thing again. I mean, in 2018, the U.S. unilaterally, abrogated the JCPOA, slapped on punitive sanctions. Iran had had 3.5 years of intense economic suffering, and it doesn't want to see that happen again. It doesn't want to sign some treaty. Only to see, to see the same thing happen either in, either later this year or in 2024 when, if Donald Trump is reelected.
Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council Ali Shamkhani has warned that if the Vienna talks do not lead to a good deal, the current U.S. administration will feel defeated in the near future due to lack of timely use of diplomatic opportunities. As all eyes are on the venue of the talks in Vienna, Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Rafael Grossi, will visit Tehran on Saturday to hold talks with Iran's nuclear chief and other top officials. The IAEA says the two sides will discuss outstanding safeguards issues with a view to addressing them. Does Grossi's trip boost the chances of a deal in Vienna? It is hard to guess at this point. The negotiations have been very complex, and there is no guarantee that they will end in a deal. It now seems that the fate of the diplomatic effort largely depends on whether the West will finally choose to make necessary political decisions.
Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has blamed the American regime for the current Ukraine crisis. He demanded an end to the war in Ukraine, saying the Islamic Republic of Iran has always opposed war and destruction anywhere in the world. The U.S. disrupted the stability of the country by interfering in its affairs and organizing rallies and creating a color coup. We oppose the killing of people and the destruction of the infrastructure of nations. Leader called the U.S. a perfect example and manifestation of modern ignorance, saying it feeds off the crises it creates all around the world.
Washington are glorified mobsters. That's all. America does to all of its allies. You've got to remember, there's a very good saying, if you're an American enemy, they might bribe you and bring you into their team. If you're their ally, good luck to you, sir.
Ayatollah Khamenei is referring to years of U.S. meddling in Ukraine since it became an independent state in 1990s. After the fall of the Soviet Union, the U.S. pledged not to expand NATO eastward close to the borders with Russia. But the U.S. and its Western allies reneged their pledges and started to include more Eastern European countries into the Western military alliance. In 2014, the U.S. implemented a color revolution in Ukraine and overthrew its democratically elected government. U.S. also supported the inclusion of right-wing groups and elements within Ukraine's government. It's now widely believed that in trying to move Ukraine into their orbit, Washington and its European allies overextended themselves, and Russia's intervention, firstly in facilitating Crimea's reunification with Moscow in 2014, then with the official recognition of the independence and sovereignty of the People's Republics of Donetsk and Luhansk, and now with a wider military operation to demilitarize and denazify Ukraine, is the result. Elsewhere, in his remarks, Ayatollah Khamenei said there are lessons to be drawn with regard to the Ukraine crisis. He said Western powers cannot be trusted and their support for their puppet regimes is only, quote, a mirage. Iran's leader said both Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky and former Afghan President Ashraf Ghani have acknowledged that the U.S. simply abandoned them amid their domestic crises. As the crisis unfolded in Ukraine, the country's president, Zelensky, being left alone by the West. The U.S. has refused to send in soldiers to the country to protect its people and has only pledged more money and weapons.
Well, the Ukrainian president was basically helped into power by American advisors and American campaign organizers. The Ukrainian president was told that he could go ahead and put down by force the Donbass ethnic Russians who revolted after the government in Ukraine banned their language and restricted their ethnic autonomy.
The same scenario happened in Afghanistan, when after 20 years of occupation, the U.S. disastrously pulled out of the country, leaving President Ghani and Afghan people alone in the face of Taliban fighters. The U.S. is facing backlash over its treatment of its Arab allies. Despite selling them weapons worth billions of dollars and pledging support, it has failed to provide them with sustainable security.
More desperate. They put you in a more serious situation than you were before, and the terms that they dictate to you are much, much more demanding than it would have been had you not taken the actions that they allowed you to take at the first. So Zelensky took actions against his own ethnic Russian citizens at the bidding of the United States, at their will.
It's now become apparent that the failure of successive U.S. presidents and their European allies since the end of the Soviet era has been to overestimate their own power and underestimate that of Russia, China, Iran, and other countries that are outside their sphere of influence.
Both Ukraine and Russia have suffered damage and casualties since Moscow's self-declared special military operation began on Thursday. Bombardment and shelling of Ukrainian cities continued on Monday. According to officials in Kiev, the Russian military struck Ukraine's second-largest city, Kharkiv, possibly killing dozens of civilians. But the Russian officials dismissed the reports of civilian deaths as not credible and part of a propaganda campaign launched by the West. The West has responded to the conflict by imposing several rounds of unprecedented sanctions on Russia, targeting its media outlets and its financial, banking, and energy sectors, among others, prompting Moscow to retaliate some of the measures. Russia says it will ride out the sanctions. The first Ukraine-Russia meeting in Belarus to reach a ceasefire concluded on Monday, with parties discussing the possibility of holding a second round of talks. Russia says it aims to, quote, denazify and demilitarize Ukraine. It also says NATO must withdraw from areas along or near Russian borders and that the West must formally recognize Moscow's control over the Crimean Peninsula.
The Russians are looking at this and seeing a redeployment of forces up to their borders from the Baltic states all the way to Korea, bellicose rhetoric coming out of Washington on a daily basis for 5 years now, and they have to know this is, it's time for us to do something. President Putin said last week, you have a knife at our throat, we had to act. And that's the mentality there. It's entirely appropriate given the recent history and the long history of relations between the U.S., Russia, Germany, Poland, and the other players in this.
Crimea has been the point of contention between the West and Moscow since its repatriation to Russia following a referendum in 2014. The U.S. and its allies reject the outcome of the vote and consider the move as illegal. Russian President Vladimir Putin said to ensure its security, his country was left with no choice but to attack Ukraine. The country also says the conflict in its western neighbor roots back years.
This crisis broke out not as a result of the launch of the Russian special military operation in Ukraine, but much earlier, when for 8 years you turned a blind eye to the crimes perpetrated by the Ukrainian nationalists in Donbas. And again, today, you did not mention at all the suffering of the residents of Donbas.
The radical nationalists, according to Russian officials, are funded and aided by the West to create a buffer zone between the two sides. That comes on top of NATO's numerous war games near Russian borders, exercises the Kremlin has slammed as provocative. But those are not the only destructive measures the Western nations, especially the U.S., have taken. Former U.S. President Donald Trump withdrew from many international accords, including key treaties with Russia, and namely the Cold War-era Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, INF, and the Open Skies Treaty. The pacts were signed in the late 80s and early 90s as means to de-escalate tensions, risking to spiral into an all-out nuclear war.
The withdrawal of the U.S. from the INF and the Open Skies Treaty and all of that tend to undermine the kind of confidence that's required right now to avoid a war. That's the first thing that has to be considered. Secondly, is that in the absence of that treaty, of course, we can assume that one of the most violative of those treaty weapons are available or probably deployed and as close to Russia as possible. Russians, certainly, military planners have to assume that. And that, again, puts them on a hair trigger in terms of deciding whether or not to fire a defense against what looks like an incoming attack.
It appears we're getting there again. The president has ordered the military to put the nuclear deterrent forces on high alert, citing what he called unfriendly gestures made by the West. The French foreign minister had earlier warned that the bloc was a nuclear power. Although experts believe the threats about a nuclear confrontation are not to lose any sleep over, the fact of them being mentioned is worrisome to many. Washington says it doesn't want to be a part of a direct conflict with Russia. Why did it pick a fight with the power then, if it wasn't willing to face the music?
Mm.
North Korea says it launched a missile on Sunday as part of developing a reconnaissance satellite system. The North has not elaborated on the type of rocket used in the test, but authorities in South Korea say it appeared to be a ballistic missile, fired from an area near Pyongyang toward the sea off its east coast. The launch was the eighth this year and the first since the end of January when North Korea fired off a record number of projectiles, including its longest-range ballistic missile since 2017. North Korea has ramped up its missile testing in 2022, announcing plans to bolster its defenses against the United States and evaluating restarting all suspended military activities. North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un had previously stated that his country's weapons development is necessary for self-defense in the face of hostile policies from the United States, including sanctions and joint military drills with South Korea. The North has also vowed to strengthen its nuclear capabilities by building more powerful atomic weapons. The exact size and strength of North Korea's nuclear arsenal are unclear. Some estimates say North Korea could have around 200 nuclear weapons by 2027. Pyongyang is believed to have tested nuclear weapons several times. It has also tested ballistic projectiles capable of reaching the United States. But why does North Korea need this expanding military program?
They learned their lesson, in essence. They learned that the United States can't be trusted, and it is willing to commit just horrific crimes against the Korean people to secure its own interests. And so North Korea doesn't want to end up the same way that Iraq is, the way Palestine is, the way Afghanistan is, because of U.S. involvement, U.S. intervention.
Meanwhile, the U.S. Indo-Pacific Command said it was consulting with its allies, South Korea and Japan, about the latest test. The command said in a statement that the U.S. condemns the launch and calls on North Korea to refrain from further, quote, destabilizing acts. Following a series of North Korean missile launches, the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden has imposed sanctions against Pyongyang. Washington has also called on the Security Council to take action against several North Korean individuals and entities accused of violating resolutions that ban North Korea's projectiles and nuclear weapons development. North Korean citizens continue to suffer because of the sanctions. The World Food Program has estimated that 10.1 million North Koreans are suffering from food shortages. Also, the UN has acknowledged that the US-backed sanctions were at least partly responsible for North Korea's food and medicine shortages.
The US sanctions against Korea have been devastating. It has significantly hurt the living standard of the people in North Korea. But with that in mind, they have pushed forward. They have continued on despite the difficult situation that they've been dealt because of U.S. foreign policy. You see that in their scientific advancements. You see that in their rebuilding of the nation after the Korean War. And you're seeing that now as they continue since the Trump administration continue to build newer and improve upon previous models of nuclear warheads.
Despite the sanctions, North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un is pursuing a plan for developing weapons that included hypersonic weapons, spy satellites, solid-fuel intercontinental ballistic missiles, and submarine-launched nuclear projectiles. Kim has intensified expanding his country's military capabilities since his diplomacy with former United States President Donald Trump ended without an agreement in 2019.
Well, I certainly hope that the U.S. is serious about improving relations, but I highly doubt it. I think perhaps the first thing that could be done is the U.S. removing its forces from South Korea, because you have to recognize that in a lot of ways, the Republic of Korea, or South Korea, is just a staging ground for U.S. and NATO forces to be right there on the demilitarized border of North Korea. And so if the U.S. is serious about improving relations, it should, in my opinion, completely withdraw from South Korea, all forces.
Trump took unprecedented steps by initiating several rounds of dialogue with the North. However, Washington blew what Pyongyang called a golden opportunity.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
A new Oxfam analysis finds that 99% of humanity is worse off due to COVID-19, while the world's 10 richest men have doubled their fortunes during the pandemic. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Jake Johnson, journalist. This article is published under the heading, After 2 years of COVID, report finds pandemic made for deadlier by greed. Here's the story. If a single word can encapsulate why, 2 years into the global COVID-19 pandemic, the virus continues to spread widely and kill thousands of people each day despite the availability of life-saving vaccines. The humanitarian group Oxfam International suggested that the word is greed. In a new report titled Pandemic of Greed, Oxfam offers a grave assessment of the current state of the public health emergency in an effort to bury the notion that the coronavirus is on its way out and normality is on the horizon, a rosy and potentially dangerous sentiment voiced in recent days by the leaders of rich nations and the executives of powerful pharmaceutical companies. While effective vaccines provide hope, their rollout has tipped from a natural desire to protect citizens into nationalism, greed, and self-interest, reads Oxfam's report compiled on behalf of the People's Vaccine Alliance, adding, large numbers of people in low-income countries face the virus unprotected, and millions of people would still be alive today if they had had access to a vaccine. Big pharmaceutical corporations have been given free rein to prioritize profits ahead of vaccine equality. Published almost exactly 2 years after the World Health Organization WHO officially declared the novel coronavirus a global pandemic, Oxfam's analysis brings together a slew of data points that, taken together, paint a picture far more dire than the one U.S. President Joe Biden presented during his closely watched State of the Union address recently. Biden said in his speech, because of the progress we've made, because of your resilience and the tools we have tonight, I can say we are moving forward safely back to more normal routines. Oxfam's report counters that. In the United States, where vaccination rates are lower than in Europe, the deaths from COVID-19 have remained high, on a par with previous waves of the pandemic. More broadly, the group notes an estimated 99% of humanity are worse off because of COVID-19, 160 million people have been pushed into poverty, and 137 million people have lost their jobs. While the pandemic has had far-reaching and destructive consequences, touching countless lives directly and indirectly across the planet, Oxfam makes clear in its new report that not everyone's livelihood has been harmed by the public health catastrophe. The report notes the richest 10 men doubled their fortunes during the pandemic, and a new billionaire is being created every 26 hours. Of those new billionaires, 40 of them have made their billions profiting from vaccines, treatments, tests, and personal protective equipment. Oxfam emphasizes that the pain inflicted by COVID-19 has been disproportionately concentrated in poor countries, which have been denied sufficient access to vaccines by rich nations and profit-seeking pharmaceutical giants that have hoarded doses and technology. Mazasayu, Global South Convener for the People's Vaccine Alliance, said in a statement recently, rich countries and corporations have tied up the global response to COVID-19 for their own benefit, leaving the Global South to bear the brunt of this pandemic. As billions of people are still unable to access vaccines, some have the audacity to claim that the pandemic is over. That is an utter fallacy. Third and fourth doses in rich countries alone cannot erase the ever-rising death toll in lower-income countries. To convey the extent of the pandemic's devastating impact on low-income countries, Oxfam's report observes, for every life lost in a rich country, another four people have died in a poorer nation. 54% of all deaths caused by COVID-19 have been in low- and lower-middle-income countries, where 10.6 million people have died. 2.7 million people are estimated to have died in high-income countries, 14% of global deaths. People in poorer nations are 1.3 times more likely to die as a result of the pandemic compared to rich countries. Per capita deaths in low- and lower-middle-income countries are 31% higher than in high-income countries. Every minute, four children around the world lose a parent or caregiver as a result of the pandemic. Almost half of these children are in India, where over 2 million children have been affected by orphanhood. Worldwide, Oxfam estimates that 19.6 million people have died as a result of the pandemic. That figure, which includes deaths directly and indirectly caused by COVID-19, is far higher than the official estimate of roughly 6 million deaths from the virus alone. At least 3 million people have died since the highly contagious Omicron variant was detected by South African scientists in November. The only way to prevent the emergence of new mutations and finally end the pandemic, Oxfam argues, is an urgent change in a strategy that includes a suspension of coronavirus-related patent protections, the transfer of vaccine technology to developing countries, and a massive increase in funds for global vaccine manufacturing. According to one recent study, producing and distributing 3 coronavirus vaccine doses to every person in low- and lower-middle-income countries would prevent over a million deaths for the cost of $61 billion, a fraction of the $778 billion U.S. military budget. To date, just 13% of people in low-income countries have received at least one coronavirus vaccine dose. Anna Marriott, Oxfam's health policy manager, in a statement said, "After 2 years, we all want this pandemic to be over. But politicians in rich countries are exploiting that fatigue to ignore the devastating impact of COVID-19 that continues to this day." While incredibly effective vaccines provided hope, rich countries derailed the global vaccine rollout with nationalism, greed, and self-interest. Marriott added, "Suggestions that we are entering a post-COVID era ignore the continuing deaths in primarily lower-income countries that could be prevented by vaccines."
Start.
Movement.
Speak.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamite.
Islamite.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all of time.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله Dear listeners, sisters and brothers, ladies and gentlemen from all around the world Welcome to another episode of Youth Station
And today we'll discuss once again some interesting topic
Yes, I'm very happy to meet you here, Zainab It's such a pleasure
again,
to be with you
My pleasure to be with you always,
yes,
Asma
it's such a happiness to be here with you
So what are we discussing, Asma?
Social media And how it has changed us Do you use Telegram, Instagram a lot?
I must say not a lot, but I do use
I would say a lot Because, you know...
Because they are designed to get you addicted.
Yes, because, you know, as we're living in a modern age, we do not have access to all our families. Some of them are abroad and we have to talk to them every
like
now
me.
And then.
Like me, yeah. My parents are in
We have
Kashmir.
To stay in contact. That's why sometimes we have to use them a lot.
But sometimes you use them a lot because of the fear of missing out.
Yes.
I personally use one of the apps a lot because I have fear of missing out some important messages, some this,
yes.
some status stories.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think this one of the fears of missing out things is one of the reasons that makes you get addicted.
Zainab, I would tell you something, some personal thing.
Sure.
Well, in past, maybe I had more time to read extra books, you know?
Of course, we
but
had.
But now, when as soon as I take my phone in my hands, then time passes like I'm not aware of it. You know, this
Allah
virtual world.
Yeah.
This virtual world is just taking us into it. We are like diving in it without knowing. Unconsciously, we're getting immensely synced in this world, right?
Yeah.
In past, we did have more time for doing some extra activities, like reading books, like going for the things we love to do, like, I don't know.
Enjoying nature.
Yes, enjoying nature. I used to do some paintings, but nowadays, I do not have that time.
Yeah, because your time is completely taken by the screen.
Yes.
There's actually a wave from, like, people started from agriculture, and then there was a wave from the agricultural wave. The wave came to some, you know, some physical hard work again. And then these economical waves changed to a digital wave.
Exactly.
And this digital wave has not only been essential for the, just for the economic
but
welfare.
But I envy people from past generations. I envy them a lot. Because I think they were living a happier life.
I think we as a generation have enjoyed both, you know. I think we have lived a life when there was no WhatsApp, no Telegram, no Instagram. Mm-hmm. And we are living in an age when we're addicted
Suddenly
to these apps.
Suddenly everything changed so much.
Yeah.
In
so
a rapid
fast.
Space.
And these apps have got tremendous potential to increase your knowledge. But at the same time, you get addicted.
Yes.
I think it's completely a user-dependent policy.
Yes.
How a user uses it.
In a rapid pace, everything has been changed. And as you said, it depends on our priority and plannings. But sometimes it just
Since it's
goes
designed
away.
In an addictive way, you cannot control sometimes. So
yes.
Not sometimes, but most of the time.
Most of the time.
For example, if two people are married and one of them is just stuck on the phone, the other thinks that he's not giving me importance anymore. Or when the, I think, parent-child relationship has been, you know, disturbed.
Exactly. In past, we had much of time to
spend with your parents,
to
talk
be
with
my
them.
Mom, to talk with her.
Yeah.
To
now, since
see our parents, our siblings, but nowadays, no, unfortunately.
Stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
Yes.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
Now let's see the other part of the story.
Yeah,
what about living without them?
Oh, wow.
Say bye to all of them.
I miss living without them. I miss the time when there was no WhatsApp,
yes.
But the emotions were
staying. But can we do it right now? Can we do it nowadays?
I think
it's impossible.
When you
travel for a week or two and you do not have access to internet and there is no connection to net, then you feel like
you have gone 20 years back. I have had
You're
this experience
thrown out of universe.
No, so I have had this experience since I'm from Kashmir. Mm-hmm. Our internet was blocked for 3 months.
Oh my God, that's such a long time.
And not only internet, Asma, just believe our mobile signals were taken away.
Oh,
we were not
good.
Able to contact each other. So we never knew what is going around, what is going on.
You feel like you're not living in this world anymore.
We just felt like we have gone not just 10 years, 20 years back. We felt like we have gone a century back.
Exactly.
That was the impact.
So difficult.
But you know what was the best part of the
mm-hmm.
story? You know, nowadays you're going to your relative's place and you're first contacting them. I am coming in some half an hour or so.
Yes.
And they make their efforts to clean the house, to be perfect. To be perfect.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. To that, like, be that masked kind of people.
Exactly.
Yeah, so
put the mask on
in order to be ready to get into that trouble. You know, now they have to spend money to cook for you what you like and what you
yes,
do not.
Yes.
And then you should not say that, oh my God, see, I went there and they did not give me chicken
yes.
or meat or something. They gave me something, I don't know, say lentils or
mm-hmm.
something else. But we went to relatives' house in around.
And perhaps neighbors came to each
and
other.
And I tell you what, Asma, We forced them to just pick out, because the people used to had a small garden kind
mm-hmm.
of thing. They used to, you know, cultivate things over there.
Yes.
We forced them to drag out them and cook that, and we eat it that.
Such a nice experience.
It was so nice. And then they liked the fact, no, we can live in a world which is without fakeness.
We got closer to each other, right?
We got to know
each other.
We got to understand each other, you know? And that way we spent more time with relatives, more time with families than on this internet stuff.
Yes,
we had a lot of problems. I mean, we were not able to contact here. We had so many problems. I mean, our half family was here, half family was
mm-hmm.
there.
Yeah.
They never knew what happened to us, where we are. We
yes,
could not
contact. It's very difficult.
If someone died, if someone was being hospitalized, you never were able to contact each other. But this time taught us a lot how to be connected to each other
yes.
without internet.
Yes, yes.
Without even mobile phones. So we went to each other's places without just informing them.
Yeah.
And however, it was the worst part was if someone died, we were not able to inform.
In these aspects, it's really sad and awful.
Yeah.
We cannot live without net or, I don't know, the signals of our cell phones. That
yes.
could do a lot of help. We are dependent
in a lot of ways, but
but as you said, it would learn us how to be independent.
Exactly.
Living without these things, though there's no deny that they are very important in our lives.
Exactly. You know, you have to imagine life without internet, without the social media, and without this digital life. And you have to point out what are the best things in the life without digital life.
Mm-hmm.
Now you have to point out best things, what are the best things in a digital life. Pick best
from both sides.
Yeah, and work on only best, mm-hmm. not work on the worst parts, you know. Never make yourself get addicted. The more you get addicted, you're breaking your relations.
Exactly.
Within your home, under one roof.
Mm-hmm.
You're not
noticing other people in your room.
You're not noticing each other. You're not noticing, you're not noticing the grays in the hairs of your mother.
Exactly. That's the thing I always say to myself. When we are detached from our I don't know, digital world, we could notice some very small things that happened to us without even us noticing them.
Exactly.
Like just what you said, my mother is getting older, my father is really getting old, my siblings are growing without me even noticing.
You notice the grays in the beard of your husband or your father.
Exactly.
We have become so much, I think, more than the addicted we were supposed to get.
Yes.
Because they are designed that way. And I wonder when the metaverse kind of thing will come. What will happen?
You remember we talked about that?
Yeah,
the metaverse, I told you at that time, it's going to be scary and at the very same time so interesting.
Exactly.
Scary because now we don't have metaverse and we are this much immersed
addictive.
In it. Now imagine what happens if
when
there is a virtual world in which we could go and travel through it and
experience things.
Experience millions of new things.
We need to pick up goods of all ages.
Yes, and planning. I always say that in life, priority does matter.
Exactly. And you know, some people say, I don't have time, I'm busy. I read this quote somewhere, this was so beautiful. There was that, no one is busy in this world, it's all about priorities.
Exactly. It's all about priority. I was talking to my friend and I told her, I'm busy, though I cannot do anything. You know?
Yeah, it's all about priorities.
It's a contrast, which is so sad to say it. That's all we have got to talk about.
Two lives, mm-hmm. with internet and without internet, with cell phones and without cell phones.
And sometimes give ourselves some space. Go a week without technology and see what happens to your
life. Happens to you?
Yes.
Really, you'll be a different person.
Yeah,
that's also a very good idea. Like live a week without
Live another life, see what happens.
The way youth especially are addicted to this digital world, mm-hmm. This time it will be very easy to go without this for a week. We can try DIYs. Step by step.
Dear youth, life is just passing. We have to give ourselves some space. We have to think more.
Exactly.
I'm one of the people who have been addicted to this world, but I do really feel sometimes that I have to give it a cut and then go back to it.
You do feel the verse that I mentioned in the Lensala.
Exactly.
Without
That's
any doubt, a human being is in loss because the time is passing. And interestingly, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala swears about time in this surah.
Exactly.
Wal Asr, the time is passing, the time is flying.
Which is terrifying. Time passes and suddenly you're 30. Suddenly you're 40.
And you're in loss. You're in loss. Allah swears that you're in loss.
So take care of your time.
Yeah, take care of
it. Because it's passing. And once it's gone forever.
So have a look at the grays of your mom.
Yes.
Have a look at the grays of your dad.
Every little thing. Now spring is coming. Notice the little blossoms in the tree.
Wow.
And the beautiful
flowers.
Notice the
nature. Notice the sound of the waterfalls around you.
Yes.
Go for a walk. Of the birds.
And leave your phone at home.
Yeah.
And try to think. Breathe.
Yeah.
Breathe the life.
About breathing as well, I would like to close with that. There's this Persian couplet. I love it. It says, I would want you to translate one by one.
Yes, sometimes give your days a rest.
Rangi,
let it breathe. Let your days breathe.
Let your time breathe. Rangi bi ayine mat bede.
Yes, the blurry mirror has to be colorful.
You just clean it up so
clean
that it shows you a very clear picture of yours. Midanam ki sarat shulugh ast.
I know that you're very busy. Sometimes give yourself a time for a visit.
Yeah, give a visit.
Visit yourself, yes.
Visit yourself.
Your There's time. Another poem that says, I miss myself.
I miss myself, yes. I really do.
Don't miss yourself. Stay with yourself and spend some time with yourself. It's very interesting. Yeah, yeah.
Give yourself a visit. Give yes. yourself a time.
Go for a visit with yourself. It's yeah. going to be so interesting. So, again, time's flying so fast, and All it right. was such an amazing time.
Same here, Asma. Same here, dear listeners.
Yes, this was IRB English Radio.
And you were listening to the Youth Station.
Yes, thank you for listening. From Stay me tuned. And from Zainab, we both bid you farewell.
Wassalamu alaikum.
Wa rahmatullah.
Wa barakatuhu.
Diverse range of programs, spirituality, youth, Eastern tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of a speech delivered on February 17, 2022 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution via video conference with the participation of people from Tabriz and East Azerbaijan, commemorating the anniversary of the Tabriz uprising of February 18, 1978.
In other words, our capabilities were limited. It was the early days of the revolution, and there were a lot of problems. In such circumstances, Imam turned the war into a tool for power and national and international credibility. For a revolutionary nation which was devoid of resources and equipment, the war was planned by the enemies to destroy the revolution. But Imam used the war as a means to strengthen and perpetuate the revolution, and to turn this threat into an opportunity, such as continuity in Imam's policies. I'd like to cite Tabriz as another example. I had met Shahid Bakri before the revolution. A friend from Mashhad who was studying at the University of Tabriz brought the late Al-Mahdi Bakri to Mashhad. I saw him there. He was an ordinary student, but Imam turned a university student into a role model, a great figure and a brilliant commander. This was Imam's work. The likes of Mahdi Bakri and Shahid Qasim Soleimani were produced by Imam. It was Imam who created them, such as the continuation of the revolution. It constantly turns the youth into great personalities and leaders of the revolution.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Therefore, the issue of the continuity of the revolutionary movement, as I said, the 29th of Bahman, was the engine of this revolutionary continuity, is one of the most important and fascinating aspects of our country's life in the present time and in the future. We must always keep this in mind and pursue, think about, act on it. And of course, everyone learned this lesson from Imam. We all learned this from Imam. So, what does continuation of the revolutionary movement mean? I have given examples. But in general, what are the examples of this continuation? Continuation of the revolutionary movement means that we consider the goals of the revolution and keep in sight all the needs of today and tomorrow, the needs of the present and the future that lead us to those goals, and satisfy these needs in whatever way possible. This means the continuation of the revolution.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
EU Foreign Affairs Ministers held yet another emergency meeting on Friday evening in Brussels to take stock of many Ukraine-related issues. The flow of refugees into EU nations was discussed at length. The impact of recently announced Western sanctions on Russia was assessed.
We are not under regime change. The sanctions are not in order to provoke a regime change in Russia.
Borrell says the sanctions are in fact designed to end the deadly conflict. NATO foreign ministers also met on Friday and reaffirmed their stance of not being drawn into the war. They acknowledged the results could be catastrophic. However, NATO allies continue to send thousands of additional troops into eastern parts of the 30-nation alliance.
And we have over 130 jets at high alert and over 200 ships from the high north to the Mediterranean.
Experts say the US is controlling all of the West's next moves, and the decision to supply deadly arms to Ukraine was a mistake.
The Europeans are saying to the Ukrainian, we're not going to send men to fight with you, we're not going to fight by your side, we give you weapons for you to fight. And had that not happened, President Zelensky would have talked to Russia from day one and avoided this war.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken attended all of the key events in Brussels on Friday, focusing on Ukraine.
unfortunately, tragically, horrifically, this may not be over soon. And so these efforts that we're making together, we have to sustain them.
A number of political commentators are saying this crisis could have been averted if Russia's legitimate security concerns had been listened to. Therefore, they suggest the onus is now on Western leaders to bring about de-escalation as a matter of urgency. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Western media coverage of the conflict in Ukraine has come under the spotlight over what's seen as racist comments by journalists and their guests talking about the crisis affecting the Ukrainian people.
Me, I'm sorry, it's really emotional for me because I see European people with blue eyes and blonde hair being killed, children being killed every day with Putin's missiles and his helicopters and his rockets.
And so, of course, I understand and respect the emotion.
But this isn't a place, with all due respect, like Iraq or Afghanistan, that has seen conflict raging for decades. You know, this is a relatively civilized, relatively European, I have to choose those words carefully too, city where you wouldn't expect that or hope that it's going to happen.
We're not talking here about Syrians fleeing the bombing of the Syrian regime backed by Putin. We're talking about Europeans living in cars that look like ours to save their lives.
People across the world were quick to react to those comments.
I support Ukraine. I'm also upset at Western leaders for being hypocritical when it comes to taking action for Yemen and Palestine. A Ukrainian's life isn't worth any more or less than that of a Palestinian or Yemeni. We are all equal. We must condemn war everywhere. If you support Ukraine but not Palestine, Syria, Lebanon, and Iraq, if you condemn Russia but not Israel and the U.S., then congratulations, mate, you're on the highest tier of hypocrisy. Where were NATO, the USA, and their people when Israel was killing innocent Palestinian children? It's not Ukraine, it's Gaza, but no one stands for them.
Social media platforms have also been filled with comments criticizing different approaches by European countries in dealing with refugees. The Ukrainians fleeing the conflict in their country have received a warm welcome by their neighbors, including Poland. No problem with that. But these European states had a totally different stance back in 2015, when an influx of refugees escaping poverty and violence in Africa and the Middle East reached Europe. Some European authorities have even drawn a distinct line between the two groups of people.
These are not the refugees we are used to. Ukrainian people are Europeans. These people are intelligent. They are educated people. This is not the refugee wave we have been used to. People we were not sure about their identity. People with unclear pasts who could have been even terrorists.
Race and nationality again become important when people fleeing the Ukraine war are received. There have been reports of Africans being turned away at the border by security forces. Some of the journalists that were caught red-handed ended up apologizing for being, quote, insensitive. But questions remain that whether being a European means the mainstream media will be more likely to talk about their distress. Many may now hope that having darker skin or being from a certain religion doesn't make others ignore their pain and suffering.
It is unusually cold in Italy for early March. Forecasters have predicted freezing weather will hit the country from north to south over the next 10 days. Italians have been told not to worry about low temperatures for now. Their homes will be heated through the winter season. However, things could be very much different in the coming future. The government, led by Prime Minister Mario Draghi, has recently issued a decree in which, besides introducing a state of emergency over the conflict in Ukraine, it also referred to possible gas rationing following its decision to do without the Russian gas. Italy imports about 95% of its gas, 45% of which is coming from Russia.
Technically, Italy is already in a state of gas supply emergency. There is a plan in place at the Energy Ministry which features three levels of intervention. The country will resort to the maximization of its fossil fuel generated power in the first place. It will take years for Italy to replace Russian gas supplies. In the short term, only about one-third of the gas provided by Moscow can be sourced elsewhere.
In the wake of the Ukraine crisis, Rome is looking to boost gas supplies from other international partners. Italy is paying dearly for not having diversified more its energy sources and its suppliers throughout the years.
In an attempt to reduce Italy's dependence on Russian gas, Foreign Minister Luigi Di Maio has recently been to Algeria to discuss ways to increase gas supplies. Algeria is the second supplier of gas to Italy.
Italy held a self-destructive attitude when it came to diversifying its energy sources.